Hello, everybody. Can you hear me at the back? Ah, excellent. Good. And can you all see all of the slide? Okay, good stuff. We've already heard today from Elsevier and Springer that they are using or going to be using semantic tagging. So I'm going to be slightly controversial in this talk and say, do we actually need semantic tagging for the sorts of things we want to do? And are there areas where it can help? And if so, how can we tell? So one thing that I've come across is that lots of different communities mean different things by semantics. One thing that was a bit of a surprise to me about the semantic web community was that they were rather interested in databases. And this wasn't semantics as in natural language semantics on the right-hand side. This was specifying what sort of data something was. So it wasn't about meaning as you would experience it in the sentences I'm using at the moment. It's about saying this string of characters is maybe a date or is a genomic sequence or that sort of thing. This is slightly different from various strands that we have in linguistics. So lexical semantics is asking the question, what do words mean in context? How do they relate to things in the world or things in your head? You know, there are questions of ambiguity and polysemy. Does bank refer to something on the edges of a river, or does it refer to the pile of money in Monopoly, or to an actual financial institution? Compositional semantics is slightly different again. It asks the question, how do we actually manage to put words together into sentences? How do we derive meaning from sentences? How do words change their meaning in context? So, two people who have had a great influence on semantics as processed by machines are on the left, Karen Spark-Jones, whose 1994 paper with Stephen Robertson led to the first search engines in the mid-1990s. And on the right, Tim Firth, who was one of the founders of a rather British, very empirical school of linguistics, which involves looking at large amounts of data in corpora about language and working out what's going on from big piles of data rather than from introspection. And of course, what's absolutely revolutionised corpus linguistics in the past few decades has been computers, so that instead of ploughing through concordances by hand, you can look at this with machines. So Karen Spark-Jones's principle is that words stand only for themselves. You can go a very long way just by taking the words in a document and not relating them to the outside world. Firth's dictum here is that you shall know a word by the company it keeps. If you only have a word on its own, if you only have the word bank sitting on a cue card or painted on a wall, then you are going to absolutely need semantic tagging to find out what it means. However, we are sitting on journal articles which are full of sentences, which are full of a vast amount of context, which help us disambiguate words in that sort of way. Now, the insights of Karen Spock-Jones led, as I've said, to the foundations of search engines. And search engines don't, in the main, use semantic methods at all. They just use statistical correlations between words and other words that co-occur in the same document and what you have typed in. Another surprising thing, at first glance, that search engines can do by purely statistical methods is machine translation. You can type something in English and you can get a slightly wonky, but more or less understandable output in another language. And this doesn't use a semantic approach, which people working with Karen Spark-Jones back in the 1950s in Cambridge, along with a student of Wittgenstein, tried out, which was an interlingua. Now, this is a very semantic method. What this involves is having something based on Roger's thesaurus. So they had a mapping from English to Roger's thesaurus, and they had a mapping from Latin to Roger's thesaurus. And via this interlingua, this semantic thing, you could do reasonable translations from Latin to English. There isn't a huge amount of call for that at the moment, but that was the data they had to hand. But Google can do translations in languages for which we don't have good resources, like Haitian Creole, for example, purely by just having enough data in the wild. If you take something from this, if you take one thing from this talk, it should probably be this paper by people who are working at Google called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Data, where they attack semantic methods. I think to some extent unfairly, but it's a rather bracing and a rather interesting read. One thing that these authors do take into account is that they have a computational linguistics background, and computational linguistics is a very sceptical profession. You can't just have a bright idea and write it up. The referees will send it back to you. They will say, we need to have good evidence that this works, and your tests have to be good. You know, you're expected to have a test that shows statistically that it succeeds both on its own terms, but also that it might be useful to somebody else. And the key thing that you have to get right if you want to get published in computational linguistics is you have to have a baseline. You have to have a method that your own method is doing better than. And if it's a new problem, then you also have to have a kind of straw man dumb model that your new exciting method, with, I don't know, semantics or whatever, is performing better than. So one thing I always bear in mind when I'm proposing that we should do something semantically at work is, do we have a dumb baseline that we can do better than? And so in a lot of cases, the best dumb baseline is just to say, we have a lot of textual data. Can we just let words stand for themselves? Can we just, instead of working out a fingerprint by referencing the paper against thesauruses, can we just say, what are the words in this paper? What other papers contain the same words? Isn't this a good enough fingerprint? And if you're a bit careful about trimming out low-frequency words, you can actually do this automatically, even if you don't know the language, using inverse document frequency, a method thought up, again, by Karen Spark-Jones back in the 1970s. Then you can get a rather good fingerprint, which you can use for finding other relevant articles. And that's what we do on our publishing platform. In fact, I wrote code for this, but we didn't even have to use that code because it's built into MarkLogic. Now, we are, of course, not all Google. Not even our friends at Elsevier are sitting on top of trillions of documents. We're often sitting on a much smaller collection of documents. Also, and I think this is critical, we don't just publish text. Okay. So we have all kinds of things which are not natural language. There's tables, there's graphics, of course. There's all kinds of images that you might use. There's tables in articles. Now, these have bits and bobs of text, but it might be unhelpful bits of text like 1A or 1B. You get a lot of that in chemistry. there's microarray data, there's crystal data, whether that's of proteins and or of small molecules. The case that I'm particularly interested in, and this is where we can go beyond text, is chemical structures. I'm also interested in this mainly because we are a chemical publisher, so we have, of course, access to quite a lot of them. So, what is the case for applying semantic methods to chemical markup? Well, at the same time as people were working out how to index really large document collections in the 1970s, they were also looking at how to do this with chemical structures, because you could actually start putting chemical structures into computers with punched cards and things. So a lot of the methods that modern chemical databases use in terms of working out what compounds are similar to other compounds by coming up with a fingerprint, go back to them. They worked on punch cards, and my colleague at the American Chemical Society's colleagues at the Chemical Abstracting Service were critical in a lot of this. A good reason for building another view of your articles based on chemical structures is that chemists think graphically. If you ask a lot of chemists, typically organic chemists, to explain something or to say what they're thinking about, they won't say, oh, I'm thinking about, and then produce a great long chemical name. They will drag you over to a whiteboard or pull a napkin out and draw what they're interested in. And if you say, how does it work, then they start drawing arrows all over the place to say what's going on. And a very exciting thing that has made all of this sort of thing possible, that has allowed us to go beyond statistics into semantics, is that we can actually extract the chemical structures. So there's automated ways of determining that from molecular names. Now, there are trivial names, which are like a human being's name, which don't actually tell you anything about it very much. Just saying that it's benzene doesn't tell you, or I don't know, vancomycin or whatever. But there are also big, long names, which you get at the end of a paper. Nobody would ever say, oh yes, and this compound is, and then produce the big, long name, because that's inconvenient. But they are in the papers, and they can be used. And the other nice thing is that authors want their chemical structures to look nice. So they don't draw them by hand. They don't draw them in Photoshop or whatever. They get specialist packages to draw them with that are guaranteed to do a nice job and make all the hexagons hexagonal and make all the everything come off at the right angle. And so these can output their data in a way that's interpretable, actually, as a chemical. Okay, so if you're thinking about taking the semantic route, as a lot of you either are or about to or already have, then there are some questions you should probably think about. So what can you achieve just by taking the words in themselves? Remember, you don't have articles consisting of a single word, unless you're publishing in a very strange language where you have very long words. You do have not just one article, but lots of articles that you can compare with each other. What is the end point? Where is the semantic markup going? What new thing are you going to be able to do? Sometimes if you build a semantic demonstrator, it's a bit like the mythical Pacific Islanders who built beautiful airfields out of wood with wooden control towers and wooden radar and wooden headphones for people in the control tower in the hope that it would attract aeroplanes. It didn't work. Semantics is really about going beyond text. What kinds of non-textual data do you have access to? So is it chemical structure? Is it images? Search engines tend to do a very bad job of images because they have very poor cues to go on. We have a slightly better chance in publishing because in our XML schemas and DTDs, we all have the images nicely paired off with a caption. It says what's in the image, so it can hopefully do nice things with it. And what sorts of external resources can be opened up to your readers? Now, Jan mentioned the Dr. House case, where he's looking at his case notes and he comes across a strangely named disease or part of the body and can look it up. And in the next talk, I believe our colleague from Nature is going to talk about using MeSH, which was developed at the National Institute of Health to index articles with for just that sort of thing. So those are my questions for you, and I think I've ended on time, so I'll come on to any questions for me. Hello.
Hi, Isabel. When you talk about the dumb baseline, could you share an example in your own operation of a kind of baseline metric that you had used to compare against semantic pattern?
Ooh, right. Okay. I will go a bit more in. I will go in a bit more detail into the example that I skipped over, in the talk. Now, this is to do with article similarity. Now, my thinking was that because organic structures, which are really pictorial, are so important to organic chemists, then a purely textual way of saying what's another relevant document to the document that you're already reading wouldn't work terribly well. So I'll say, right, okay, what we will do, because this may be fiddly to do, because it will involve finding structures and so on and so forth, we'll just do a dumb one. It'll work just on the words. It'll work really well for analytical chemistry because they care about methods and methods and machines. It'll work really well for physical chemistry because they talk about theories and that sort of thing. And if it works on organic chemistry, then it'll be a bonus. And lo and behold, it seems to work pretty well. In fact, it works so well that we don't really see the point in trying to do the clever method as well. Though we do, if we do decide to have the clever method, we do have a metric, which is, do we get clicks on the relevant articles.
Hi, Colin. Brian Hickley, Biomed Central, and Paul Mankowski. I was just wanted to ask you a question about, I often think authors are readers are authors. When authors give us things, they tend to kill it and send you a Word document or a PDF with no enrichment in it. Microsoft have been doing some work on the chemistry plugin, the authoring tool for Word. I wondered how that might be, what the take up of that might be, and how it's impacting what RST is doing.
Oh right, no, that's a good question. That's an excellent point. Because chemistry is a discipline where there are clear benefits to going beyond text, unlike say Latin criticism, which a friend of mine researches, you would think that this would be taken up. It's really, really early days with the Chemistry for Word plugin, so it's possible to use it a bit. I think they've marked up a few paragraphs using it, but I don't think anybody's been quite brave enough to write an entire article in it yet. But when they do, we look forward to that.